Welcome to the Food Professor Podcast, presented by Cattle, Season 6, Episode 2. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm the Food Professor, Sylvain Charlebois.
Our very special guest for this episode, our first guest of the season, is Greg Mercer, award-winning investigative reporter for the Globe and Mail. Just released his first book. I'm holding it up right here. If you join us on YouTube, you can see the front cover, Lobster Trap, looking at the past, present, and future of the global and Canadian lobster industry. Not the first nor the last time we'll be talking about those cannibal crustaceans, Sylvain.
Yeah, that's one way to describe lobsters for sure. But lobster is a big industry, of course, in the Atlantic. And Greg did a pretty good job with his book describing the history of the cockroach of the sea, what it means to our economy, and the dark side of the industry as well. I think he really, he didn't hesitate to go into certain places to describe exactly what went on or what is going on, how the industry actually works. Because we often talk about the beautiful parts of the industry. We never talk about, things that aren't necessarily reported.
Yeah. Or have been. Like, there's been a lot of conflict with First Nations. There's, all kinds of trade disputes
that's
going
being
on.
Reported.
Very complicated. Yeah.
But absolutely. I think Greg does a pretty good job explaining the realities of the industry overall.
Well, we'll get to that a little bit later. It's a great start to the interview. We've got lots of great interviews lined up. Now, what's the, just wanted to check in with you. What's the status of the Dalhousie lockout? Are they back at school? Are you back on your email or what's going on?
No emails, nothing, no auto replies, no transfer emails. So if you're sending me emails in the last 15 days, 16 days, I'm not getting anything. So I'm using Gmail. We're still locked out. QP just voted in favor of a strike now, and QP would include research assistants, teaching assistants, and part-time teachers. So it's a bit of a mess right now. Mm-hmm. And I was actually at McGill yesterday teaching my first class, and everyone was asking what was going on there, and there is some solidarity between faculties, of course.
Sure,
but I feel bad for students and parents. They're just waiting to know what is going to happen. This is the first time we've seen a lockout affecting a major university in Canada. So it's kind of weird.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll keep tuned in on that. So as a reminder, for anybody who's trying to reach Sylvain, the usual things. And for many of us, when I hit your name, it populates the you and I have missed a few emails because of my fault. It auto-populates your Dal email, so I got to switch it to the Gmail. But anyway, there you go. So
It is what it is.
So in this episode, we're going to talk about Kraft Heinz. We're going to talk about meal kits. We're going to talk about Crown Royal. And the Ontario Premier, more canola trouble.
Nestle. Lots to talk about,
New leadership at McDonald's Canada, and the Retail Council of Canada. So anyway, let's jump in with this whole Kraft Heinz splitting up. So this is it's a big story in one way. I saw that, who was it, Berkshire Hathaway frowned upon it. And, it's funny, we talked about mergers and acquisitions last week. So now
Dr. Pepper and Keurig.
What do you make of this? I mean, last week, you proposed as well, that the trade turbulence, the restructuring of capitalism, just a reinvention of how business is done in some ways, good, bad, or not so equal, have people restructuring and rethinking about how they structure their business. What's the impact here in Canada, and what do you make of this change?
Well, if you go back in history, of course, Kraft Heinz merged 10 years ago, I guess, in 2015, with the help of Berkshire Hathaway, with Warren Buffett and 3G Capital out of Brazil. And their style was about cutting and bill efficiencies. That's how that's their way to extract value from a company. And that led to the closing of Lymington. Do you remember that?
Right. Like,
the Lymington plant closed in 2016.
My switch to French's ketchup.
Which led to the ketchup wars, of course, and forcing Loblaw to release French's. Anyways, there's some history there for sure. And at the time, the idea was big is beautiful. And I think the big is beautiful mantra impacted the entire CPG space, because you saw Dr. Pepper and Keurig. You saw Kellogg's as well merging, and you saw many different companies becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And now what's interesting, the last 12 months, we're seeing the reversal. So Kellogg's with Kellanova, Dr. Pepper and Keurig. Because a couple of weeks ago, they decided to separate coffee with non-coffee products. And now we're hearing, and it's not much of a surprise, because we were hearing rumors where they're splitting the company into two. Not necessarily Kraft and Heinz as they were before 2015. Mm-hmm. They will actually separate grocery with certain staples, I think, for the service industry overall. So it's going to be interesting to watch. I'm actually touring the Kraft Heinz plant in Montreal next week. In Mont-Royal, they actually manufacture peanut butter, ketchup, and cream cheese. Huh. And when you look at what's being proposed as a new structure, I don't know exactly how that's going to work and how that's going to impact this mega plant in Montreal. So very logical. Makes a whole lot of sense. You got to wonder what's next. And I think what's next is that I do think that companies will start to look at local much more seriously. They won't necessarily look at regions, world regions like North America, Europe, Asia. They'll start actually looking at micro markets much more closely. And that's kind of, I wouldn't say it's Trump's legacy with nationalism and tariffs, but I suspect it's really pushing companies to rethink how they commercialize, how they manufacture products overall.
You know, my take on some of this is also something I think about a lot, which, you know, all companies are trying to grow. And sometimes I would characterize them as having not an expense problem, because as you say, you know, they probably got ring tight from all expenses. So they don't have a cost problem. What they've got is they got a growth and relevance problem.
I actually agree. Yeah. You know, I agree with you. And frankly, I mean, you gotta admit, I mean, there are two other factors pushing companies to rethink how they distribute products. You got the private labeling thing going on. More and more grocers are pushing, especially in North America, they're pushing their private labels. And the Ozempic factor. I mean, let's talk about this. I mean, it's important. We've talked about this before on the pod. I'm hearing more and more about Ozempic. We talked about it last week. And I think it's pushing companies to think differently about ingredients, how to market certain products overall. And there's some adaptation that is required. And that level of adaptation will vary from one market to another.
Let's stick with CPG. So a big announcement, a local favorite. It was a favorite of my household, Yves. I like their ground veggie in my shepherd's pie, actually.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And they used to make a breakfast, a flat disc breakfast sausage, which was very, very good. But I can't find it anymore. So I wanted to ask you, so the news...
Well, I guess you won't find anything anymore.
Well, I guess...
It was an American company, and I can't remember the name, but it was bought by that company many, many years ago. Yves Potvin, who I've actually met, he lives in Vancouver now, started the company, and he's now into he's supporting other startups right now. The company changed, and I think a couple of things have happened there. First of all, I think that the Potvin or the Yves brand is one of the best in the country when it comes to plant-based. I mean, these products were very good, but they were very expensive too. And I think the plant-based space retail got really competitive, because many years, 25, 30 years ago, Yves was basically that was it. That was the only brand you could find, and you need to know what you were looking for. But now there's so much competition. Lactalis actually this summer announced that it was closing its Sudbury plant, so it's actually exiting the plant-based market as well. I do think that margins have gotten tighter. It's becoming more difficult to compete, and I think the American company decided to withdraw Ease because they just didn't feel that there was a strong case to re-energize the brand, basically.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting point. It's Hain Celesto, by the way. I was just checking
okay,
it out.
Okay, thank you.
Is this a case of, I mean, from when that big company bought them, they seem to get lost. Like, I saw no or little innovation in the category in their products. They changed their logo and packaging, I think, what, just after they bought them. Fine.
Yep.
But then I didn't see any great innovation in the
there
product
was no effort,
at all.
No.
So, you know, I guess is it, you know, they're saying, listen, the whole plant-based thing didn't work out. I'm not quite sure that's the answer. I mean, I feel like they had a great toehold. Maybe it's too small a business for the American company to care about as well. But I didn't see a lot of innovation. I don't know. Maybe they got a different story to tell us. Love to hear from them and say, no, we tried, but on my grocery shelf, I didn't see.
Well, one thing I don't know was the product sold in the US as well? My understanding is that it wasn't. It was really a Canadian market thing. Mm. And the Canadian market is pretty tight right now. Canadians are really careful with their money. You're seeing more discount stores opening up all over the place. And so unlike the US, the economy is not growing. It's actually shrinking. You saw the GDP numbers. That's never a good thing for the food business, is because people have less money. And so,
I hear Beyond Beef is in real trouble. I hear, I'd be surprised if the next, I'd be surprised not to hear the next one getting in announced trouble isn't Beyond Beef. They're putting out some real vibes about real trouble.
Yeah.
You know, it's a premium, it's probably a premium product now. And, you know, the whole rationale of Omna, you know, these flexitarians didn't really hold true. Anyway, we're going to miss it in our family. We're going to stock up because I do like it.
It is a premium product, and premium products are having a hard time right now across the country, unfortunately. So, yeah, Eves was an innovator, but and frankly, I don't think people understand what the withdrawal or the discontinuance of the brand actually means. To me, I didn't care about the plant-based. Plant-based is certainly one thing that you need to follow. But frankly, when you see these products disappear, that's not a good sign.
Just less choice, right? Just less choice.
Less choice, less growth. And it's not great. I'm hoping that at some point we'll see. Retail sales are up again, like food retail sales are up again, finally, in the spring. But it's still a tough go for grocers, for sure.
Let's talk about another, should we call it a premium product? Meal kits. So take us through your latest thoughts and findings on the meal kit business. We've talked about it several times on the podcast. It's not exactly a meal kit. We had the president of We Cook on last season, which isn't a meal kit in as much as you don't put it together. By the way, I continue to buy it for my mom every couple of weeks. She loves it. Just pop it in the microwave. Great food. Shout out to the folks at We Cook. But what have you discovered about meal kit?
Yeah, We Cook is actually a meal. I mean, it's just a ready-to-eat meal.
Done, assembled, ready to go. It's perfect for my mom. Love it.
Meal kits are like the IKEA of food. You basically are
Without an Allen key, you can't eat with the Allen key. That's the only.
Yeah, there's too much. They're called leftovers. With IKEA, if there are spare parts, that's a problem. With meal kits, I mean, here's the thing: our lab surveyed Canadians 3 weeks before the pandemic on meal kits, and so I called Cattle Ransom and asked them to survey Canadians again using the same survey, the same questionnaire, and asked them the same question, whether or not they're using meal kits. Are they subscribers? What service are they using? And if they're not using the service anymore? Why? And why are they using? And so it was really interesting. And the results are pretty interesting. So back in 2020, 4.5% of Canadians were subscribers. They actually did use meal kits on a regular basis, i.e. once a week. Okay. Now we're up to 8.5%.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So now it is a survey. It's always difficult to know really what the real number is, but it's always interesting to ask the people who no longer use a service like that, why aren't they using a service like that anymore? And the number one reason is price. 70% of Canadians actually have decided not to stay with a meal kit provider because of price. And second is basically packaging at about 20%. So that's really something that annoys a lot of people. They
you think mean too much packaging and
plastics. Yeah, I mean we actually use a meal kit provider at home, and sometimes actually we send meal kits to our kids at universities, different universities, and it's helpful. But the problem is the packaging. It's just a lot of stuff. Like you got the styrofoam, the plastics. You got a lot of stuff to keep things fresh, right? Because sometimes your meal kits are delivered early in the morning and you won't come back from work until 4 or 5.
It's same with We Cook. It arrives and there's 4 or 5 freezer packs in there.
Yeah.
Now they're reusable. So I've got like a giant chest full of, you know, gel freezer packs. So that's
and
reusable.
It's well done. I mean, if you're looking for ideas, I mean, right now, people going back to school and everything else, parents are pressed for time. And sometimes after a couple of weeks, when kids are back in school, you're struggling to, you're struggling to find ideas to feed your family. Well, actually, meal kits are pretty good with that. They're constantly innovating, providing their subscribers with new ideas. So that's great. But it is pricey. It is pretty pricey. It can vary
premium
from
service.
It may actually be it can be anywhere between $8 to $12 per person, and you still have to work. Back in 2020, we measured that the market for meal kits in Canada was about 600 million, 700 million, and right now we believe it's over 1.2 billion now.
Yeah, exceeded expectations. So, interesting.
But we don't believe there'll be new entrants, newcomers, new companies. We are expecting some consolidation. HelloFresh is the big market leader. Good Food is number two, and I believe Chef's Plate is number three. We're expecting some consolidation because really prices aren't really moving up. And to operate a meal kit provider is pretty expensive.
It's a logistic intense business, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Business. Need fast, reliable Canadian shopper insights? Meet Rapid Response, Cattle's most popular survey tool. In just 5 questions, you can reach any audience in Canada, French, English, or both, with results delivered in as little as 5 business days. Whether you've got a big retailer meeting coming up or need quick, credible data to guide decisions, Rapid Response gives you expert research and a powerful Excel-based dashboard, all for just $2,500, with subscription options that can save you even more. As a listener of the Food Professor podcast, your first Rapid Response is free. Just email at insights@cattle.ca and mention the Food Professor. That's insights@cattle.ca. All right, let's move on to a couple things before we get into our interview with Greg. We got some good news, I think, in Canadian Indo relations. It takes a turn for normalization.
Yes.
New high commissioners on both sides, both 35-year veterans. It seems like, you know, we got veteran diplomats on both sides. I guess this was agreed to in a pull aside back at the G7. I mean, India, it's fascinating because India is getting, as of last week, punished by America for, you know, suddenly America's mad at them for buying Russian oil. So, you know, is this the beginning of a new opportunity or a greater opportunity? We've been hoping that there'd be some breakthrough with India. Could this be it?
I think so. I think that's That's the kind of sign you should be looking for when it comes to diplomacy. Obviously, our relationships, our relationship with India hasn't been great, especially since Prime Minister Trudeau accused India of murder, essentially. And that was, I believe, a couple of years ago. And now with a new leader, with Prime Minister Carney, I actually think since he has become Prime Minister, he's done a pretty good job with his rapprochement with mm-hmm. India, invited Prime Minister Modi to the G7 in June, which is mm-hmm. great. And now we have people in the embassy in both Ottawa and New Delhi. So lots of positive signs. And of course, we need a strong relationship with India. India right now is not a huge trading partner, but it should. It should. I mean, it's not even in the top 20 right now, but it should be a really strong trading partner of ours.
Next, we got more canola trouble. Canada is asking the US EPA for an exception, barring canola as used for biofuels. I guess this is another barrier from the Americans to our canola farmers, right? You know, it's kind of like, you know, again, if we remove the China EV tariffs, the Americans might say, well, no exception for you, you know.
So, no exception for you. No soup for you.
No soup for you. We seem to be every day, every week, between a rock and a different harder place.
Yeah, I know. No, it's not great for canola growers. And obviously, there is some pivoting. I'm actually expecting next year to see many farmers move away from canola. They'll probably produce something else because of the negative trading environment that we're seeing on many fronts, China, the U.S. And so it's not helpful. It doesn't help farmers in Canada. And canola is really a precious thing for Canadians. So it's not great. I mean, canola prices are depressed. They're very low. So we are expecting many farms in Canada to break even, maybe make a little money, but not. It's not like it was a few years ago. A few years ago, they actually did make some good money, but not this year. And it's not because of droughts or climate. It's because of geopolitics. Yeah, which is really frustrating.
Well, speaking of geopolitics, let's get to our interview with Greg Mercer from his book, The Lobster Trap, all about it with a great conversation with Greg. Greg, welcome to the Food Professor Podcast, our first interview of our sixth season. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here, and thanks for having me. This is great.
Fantastic. Where are we finding you today?
I am in Darling's Island, New Brunswick, which is where I grew up. I'm home with my family visiting my parents for a few days. So it's about 20 minutes inland from St. John, so in the southern part of the province.
St. John.
I was going to ask you because, you know, being a LeBlanc, we had a cottage and lots of relatives in Shediac and Moncton. So I was going to kind of help the listener triangulate where you were. Well, I can't imagine a better person to talk about lobster than somebody living in New Brunswick, right, Sylvain? I mean, even though there's lots in Halifax, it's a thriving and interesting
business. Well,
lobster's
a big deal in the Atlantic, and of course, in both Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, it's a big sector. It's a huge sector for our economy. So it was. I mean, the title itself caught my attention, Lobster Trap, and the way that Greg wrote the book, and he really got involved with the industry. So I was really looking forward to read it.
Greg, did you come up with that title? Did it feel a little kitschy when it first came up?
It's one of these things where you love it and then you hate it and then you love it again and you think it's corny. But what I was trying to do with that idea is get across, you know, the idea that there's real tension in the industry and that they are in a bit of a trap, that fishermen cannot afford to slow down, and that's speeding up the decline. At least there's a lot of worry that it's speeding up the decline in the industry. So that's what I'm trying to get across with the lobster trap.
Oh, fantastic. It reminded me, I have a lobster trap in my garage from the 50s that was a kind of a hand down from my dad. So I have one. I won myself. Anyway, enough about lobster traps. We're going to get lots into the book coming up. But let's talk about you for a bit. Who are you? And, you know, how did you get into this? You know, you're an accomplished career. You have an accomplished career in investigative journalism. How did you get into that? Were you always wanting to be a journalist? Were you always curious and telling stories. Talk about your background a bit.
I kind of fell into it as a teenager, I guess, in the early days. It wasn't really on my radar until I was in, I think, grade 11 in high school. And a teacher asked me if I wanted to get out of class early on Fridays. And I said, sure, before I asked what was the catch. she wanted someone to write stories for the local weekly newspaper about the high school hockey team. And I kind of fell into it and had a lot of fun with it. And it kind of opened my eyes to, hey, that, you know, maybe writing is a career. Maybe, you know, working for newspapers is a career that I should pursue. And it just kind of went from there. I studied it in university, went to St. Thomas in Fredericton. And then started working for the daily paper near where I grew up in St. John, and went on to write for newspapers across the country. Eventually settled in Ontario and began working for the Globe and Mail, the national mm-hmm. newspaper that covers Canada coast to coast. And I was their Atlantic Canada reporter for about 4 years when it first began, and now I'm on the investigative team.
So as the Atlantic Canada liaison, I guess you were still in Toronto, or were you based out of Halifax?
I was based out of Halifax first, and then St. John. During COVID, we picked up and moved the family to St. John. Just the kids were quite young, and it was a chance to have some family help. And I mean, everything we were doing at that time was remote anyway, so where the bureau was based was less important, as long as we were in the region.
Trapped in your bubble. I remember those days, right?
Yes, crazy. Yeah.
Crazy days. Hey, you're not just a journalist, so to speak, but you're an investigative journalist, which is a particular, I don't know, genre. Or how did you get into that? What does it take to be a great investigative journalist? And then how do you choose your subjects? You did the great reporting on the drone spying scandal. Was that like, hey, there's a bunch of sports reporters here in Paris, and we need an investigative reporter right away. We got a story here. How does this all happen?
Well, often the way we get into stories is that the newspaper will decide kind of as an institution, where do we want to invest our resources? Because investigative stories can sometimes take months before you produce a single story. So it is a big commitment from the paper when we say we're going to take a deep look at Canada soccer in that case. And look at the questions around spying at the Olympics, and we try to pick stories that are in the public interest. We try to pick stories that hopefully can affect public policy or expose wrongdoings by government or by public institutions. You know, we spent months digging into the assassination of Hardik Singh Nijjar, the Sikh activist in Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. You know, these are the kind of stories we try to take on, and we spend months pursuing the story until it's complete. And a lot of it sometimes is just developing sources, getting people to trust you, to tell you where documents are, to help you ask the right questions. And it is really, it takes a lot of patience and persistence. It's very different from daily news reporting.
Oh, absolutely. Really, I've been involved with some of the investigative work led by the Globe and Mail over the last few years. The most latest one was with the Great Value Silk recall. Your colleagues actually did some great work, and I believe it took about 6 months of work to and then a couple of articles were released as a result. So great work from the Globe and Mail for sure.
Yeah, I feel really lucky to work for the Globe because they still give us license and resources to pursue stories globally, which is harder and harder in the newspaper world these days. So I feel very lucky to be working there.
Especially in the agri-food sector, we seem to be missing a lot of capacity compared to just 10, 15, 20 years ago. When I started my career 25 years ago, we saw a lot more investigative work looking at the agri-food sector, but now it's just a few outlets looking into the sector.
Yeah, this is it. You're right. Everything has shrunk, right? But I do think the public and readers and audiences still want that kind of journalism.
Oh, absolutely. I want that kind of work too. So let's talk about your book, your first book, The Lobster Trap, The Global Fight for Seafood on the Brink. The cockroach of the sea became this luxury food product all of a sudden. And you do explain it in your book. So why lobster? Why lobster for your first book?
I mean, one, I just think the story of lobster is a fascinating story, right? Just as you're alluding to, how it evolved from this kind of poor person's food to this global luxury food. That story in and of itself, to me, is interesting. But the more I dug into this as a reporter, the more people were sharing with me the concerns and about, you know, where it's all going, that the future of lobster, which, you know, until recently was very much booming and a lot of people thought it would, you know, never end. A lot of folks are worried about where this is all going. You know, growing up in the Maritimes, lobster was always in the background. It was something that showed up at family gatherings and, you know, it was sort of a special occasion food. And I was sort of exposed to it from a distance, right? I used to do deliveries for my father's water conditioning business, going into fishing communities all across New Brunswick. So you hear stories and you go to places like Grand Manan, which is an island off the coast of New Brunswick, where everybody seemed to be buying brand new pickup trucks and renovating their houses. And people say, oh, that's lobster money. So you kind of had this idea that there's a big boom going on, but it didn't really understand what was driving it. So I guess all that kind of led to an interest in it. And then it was really 5 years ago was the real genesis for the book, when we had the big fight blow up in Nova Scotia over the indigenous lobster fishery. And folks might remember kind of how that made national news. People were burning boats and shooting at each other. And there was a warehouse that was ransacked and angry mobs. And that kind of was the impetus to really go down this road.
Yeah, and in some communities, there's still some tensions brewing still to this day. Eh?
Absolutely. I mean, the violence has really subsided over that question, but the tension is still there. It has not been resolved. And Canada still has left this kind of – there's unfinished business, I suppose, when it comes to the Indigenous fishery. And so when I dug into the book, I wanted to get into that because naively I thought – there's lots of lobster in the sea. What's the big deal? What are we so worked up about? And the more you dig into anything, you realize that the truth is a bit more murky. It's not quite that simple of a solution.
Exactly. Now you are from New Brunswick, but you did start off your book talking about the dramatic collapse of Rhode Island's lobster fishery. So why did you start there?
I wanted to take people to the U.S., particularly to the southern part of New England, where the lobster fishery has collapsed, because I want to show them how bad things can get, right? I mean, that part of New England used to be the absolute heart of America's lobster fishery. This is the place that invented the lobster roll. It's where most of the lobster at one time used to come from. And if you go there now, there's virtually nothing left. There's a handful of fishermen still catching lobster. They told me it's barely worth their time to go out on the water to catch lobster. Wow. They can barely pay their fuel bills. So I wanted to understand, how can something that was booming so much a few decades ago collapse so rapidly and change an entire way of life for these coastal communities? To me, that serves as a warning for Canada, which has been enjoying this unprecedented boom in lobster catches. And I want to tell readers that it can also end here. And certainly, yes, there are differences in the Canadian and the American fisheries when it comes to lobster, but we should not be so complacent as to think, oh, we'll be just fine. And that's kind of what I wanted to tell with that story.
Right, right. And you do talk about China. China is a huge customer of ours. I've spoken to the Canadian Lobster Council over the years with Jeff Irvine. It's CEO. He's got some funny stories about China. Often Canadian lobster is often positioned as Boston lobster from Canada, which is interesting. To your point about the fact that lobsters really started in the U.S., but China is a big, big customer of ours. Of course, there are tariffs imposed on Canadian lobster right now, but tell us about, you know, global demand for Canadian lobster in general with China and beyond China.
Yeah, I mean, the arrival of China as a market for live lobster has been the single biggest change in the fishery in the last 20 years. You know, 25 years ago, there were lots of people in mainland China who had never seen a Canadian or a North American lobster, let alone eaten one. And that's completely changed now. Now it is a status symbol for wealthy folks in China. You know, if you're having a wedding and you're having a buffet, you want lobster on the table. And that arrival of China as a market has upended all the old rules about lobster and exporting. And it's also driven the price through the roof. Like, if we want to understand why we're paying $35 for a lobster sandwich in Prince Edward Island today, we need to look no further than China. So That's been good for fishermen in the sense that they're getting historically high prices. It's also put unprecedented pressure on the fishery because the world has developed a taste for our lobster. And I wanted to understand, well, what does all this mean and where is it going? You know, I've talked to a lot of seafood exporters in China who said how much it's evolved has been head spinning, how quickly it's happened. They say a couple of decades ago, they would truck live lobster around in unrefrigerated trucks and they would arrive dead to their destinations. They have evolved so quickly to, improve logistics and modern refrigeration that we can get a lobster from Nova Scotia to Beijing in a couple of days. That's all new. And so it remains to be seen if the lobster population can survive that kind of improvement in technology and this intensity of fishing, right? Because we can't grow any more lobster, right? Not at least on a commercial scale. We have to go to where the lobster are. We have to catch them. And as the world's appetite for lobster grows, I just want to understand what does that mean?
For people, I'll ask you another question and I'll pass it back to Michael. For people who enjoy lobster rolls or just a lobster when they go out to a restaurant or when they prepare something at home, what's the one thing that you would want listeners, readers to know about the lobster industry in general?
Well, I do think a couple of things. They should feel that when they buy a lobster roll, they're supporting coastal communities, and that's a good thing. I think that we should not take for granted that we're going to have lots of lobster forever. I think that there's a lot of signs that the lobster populations are under stress. I do think the fishery does good things in terms of conservation, like throwing back egg-bearing females. Those are good things that the industry does. But we should never assume that 50 years from now, we'll be able to all still be eating lobster rolls in the way that we're eating them now. We don't have a great track record as people when it comes to a seafood or fishery that is in global demand in the way that lobster is.
I want to get back to the consumption and then just the transformation of the industry, thanks to the appetite, both real and for the product. I mean, the fact it's red is also very helpful, right? Lucky color in China. I mean, it all comes together.
That's
now,
great.
Now we've got these tariffs that are on. First, there were tariffs from China on U.S. lobster that helped create the market here in Canada, even though there's a lot of lobster that kind of crosses both borders. But, you know, now we've got some tariffs from China on Canadian lobster. Now, they've kind of settled their whatever with Australia, who's also a big exporter. Like when we look globally, who else is supplying lobster? You know, Jeff Irvine would tell us the Canadian lobster is fantastic because it's deeper, colder water and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, is there global competitors that we need to think about as our policymakers think about how to handle China and our relations with them and our trade relations?
Yeah, there definitely is. Certainly when it comes to the North American lobster with the big claws, you know, with the large tails and the cold water meat, you can only catch that in the North Atlantic. But Europe also catches a similar species of lobster. Of course, it is about twice the price of Canadian lobster. There are actually dozens and dozens of different lobster species around the world.
Why is it twice the price? Why?
Because it's so rare in Europe, because they have overfished it to the point where it is really an artisanal fishery in the UK and around France. So if you want to buy a local lobster there, be prepared to shell out a lot.
Good use of phrase, by the way.
Right. So there are alternatives for Chinese consumers. So everybody's kind of watching to see what happens with tariffs from China. This is the single largest customer in the world of live Canadian lobster. Yes, if this is a prolonged trade spat, it's unquestionably going to have an impact on the fishery. When it happened in 2018, when Donald Trump and Beijing had their trade spat, it devastated the American fishery. Mm-hmm. So the worry is that can now happen to Canadian fishermen.
Yeah.
And they're sort of actively trying to find other markets outside of China so we're not so reliant on this one behemoth.
You know, you talk about it's not like Canada hasn't seen collapse of different fisheries. We talk about the cod disaster in the 90s. From your reporting, what are the prescriptions for that not happening? You know, what are the kind of things that people should be and are thinking about to make sure, you know, history doesn't repeat itself in this with lobster?
Well, I mean, I think you know, in the simplest terms, let's make fishing policy decisions based on ecological factors rather than economical economic factors. Hmm. You know, there's lots of evidence that lobster stocks are under stress. We don't see the jumbo lobsters anymore, the largest, you know, the best breeders in the population, because they have been fished out. There are things we could do around size restriction, both on the large size and the small size, to give lobster more time to mature and reproduce and grow. You know, we're using bigger boats. We're going out further to sea, and much like we did with the cod fishery, that, you know, while total catches may be going up and down every year, that sort of masks the fishing effort. We're fishing harder and harder to catch even less than we caught last year. And those are some of the warning signs that were happening with cod that we ignored for a long time.
You know, there's a guy I watch on YouTube who's a lobster fisherman. I don't know if you've seen him. He's great, very charismatic, and he always grabs these lobsters and you know, he finds like a breeding female and notches the tail and said, we're going to put her back in because, you know, that seems like a hard thing to do at a mass level when you got a giant boat pulling lobsters from the bottom. Like, does it still happen? Are those still just basic rules in place for?
No, I mean, it's enforced. I mean, if you're caught with egg-bearing females, you can be fine. So fishermen, I think they are trying to abide by those rules. I think they understand. But there's a lot of other things that we could be doing in terms of, like, don't catch lobsters quite as small, or let the larger ones go. You know, it's unclear if we have the ability to pull back on the reins, because right now the market is incentivizing fishermen to catch as much as they possibly can because prices are so historically high. And so if that's the driver, if revenues are the single biggest driver in terms of conservation right now, that leads us to a very troubling place. And we don't have to look far. You look down to the U.S. to see what's happened when the lobster disappear, right? So I think there is a lot of concern that the cod fishery was not a one and done, that we can do it again with lobster if we're not careful.
Let's spend a couple of minutes on the indigenous issue, because it's particularly gnarly. You talk about it in the book, and as we talked about up front, it flared up in violence, and as Sylvain said, it hasn't gone away. There's still conflicts around unregulated seasons, fair participation. Based on what you've learned, is there a fair resolution out there that would work for both for the indigenous and commercial fishermen?
I mean, I think so. It's a thorny issue. And you know, there is a reason why Ottawa has failed to kind of properly resolve this. And in the more than two decades since we had the big Supreme Court decision, the Marshall decision, which reaffirmed that Indigenous folks on the East Coast have a right to fish for a moderate livelihood. You know, that right goes back centuries to when the Mi'kmaq people and the Indigenous folks signed treaties with the British. This was long before Canada was a country. The problem is, how do we interpret that in the modern age? How do we interpret that with modern commercial fleets and commercial equipment? And what does it look like? So I think most, even commercial fishermen, will agree that Indigenous folks have a right to fish lobster. It's just, how is it regulated? When can they fish? Do they play by the same rules as us? I think a good starting point is to stop negotiating First Nation by First Nation. Right now, Ottawa is signing deals with one, Mi'kmaq community at a time. A lot of folks have said they need to allow these communities the chance to work together and to buy licenses and equipment from non-Indigenous fishermen, and then everyone play by the same rules, to fish within the same seasons, rather than having some bands, you know, fishing in the summertime when other commercial fleets are at the wharf, because that's a really sensitive time for the fishery. The lobster are shedding, and there's a lot of concern about the impact that that's having on lobster.
I really enjoyed your book. Very comprehensive. You look at all angles. Congratulations. Now, if we take out a crystal ball and look at the future of the industry over the next, say, 20 years or so, how do you think the lobster industry will look like in Canada?
I think it's unquestionably, it's going to look different. I think if you go to places like Newfoundland or, you know, the eastern shore of Quebec, sort of the more northern regions of the fishery, it should still be a healthy fishery. The concern is in the southern part of where we catch lobster in Canada. We know that the ocean is warming. We know that lobster are incredibly sensitive to changes in their environment, and that has all kinds of implications for the way they reproduce, the way they migrate, the way they grow, how resilient they are to things like shell disease. So as the ocean continues to change, the whole environment in which we're catching lobster is changing along with it. For a worst case scenario, you could look to a place like Europe. I went to the UK as part of this story into Ireland, and fishermen there describe a fishery that is just, it's a shadow of its former self. If we just put our heads in the sand and do nothing, there is a real concern that it could dwindle to that size. If we can bring in some regulation that at least protects lobster to the point where they have a better chance at sustainability, it might look different. But we know there's dramatic changes happening in the ocean, and there's no simple solution for that. There's no lever that we can pull right away. You know, lobster farming has some promise, and lots of people have tried that. The problem is it takes an awfully long time for lobster to grow to adult size.
It's 5 to 7 years, is
exactly.
it, for a one-pounder? Yeah,
that's right.
And they don't like each other, right?
They don't like each other, and people have tried it, and the problem is no one has been able to replicate what the ocean does naturally. So there are folks who are in that world doing that kind of research now saying now is exactly the time we ought to be doing this and funding this kind of science and research, because if we wait 20 years, it's going to be too late. We need to figure this out now. Can we farm lobster in the same way that we farm oysters or farm salmon? And it's proven that it can be done. It's, can you do it on a commercial scale?
Listen, Greg, fascinating story, fascinating talk. Thank you again for joining the Food Professor podcast today. Just to remind our folks out there, Greg Mercer is the author of The Lobster Trap, The Global Fight for a Seafood on the Break. Greg, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
One of my father's favorite beverages, I found a lot of bottles of Crown Royal when I was clearing out the house in Ottawa. He had lots of bottles, some back from the 40s and 50s, actually. So they're a very popular drink, but not so popular this week with the Ontario Premier, who poured in a show of you hurt me, I hurt you. What's going on? What do you make of this?
I don't know how you felt when you saw Premier Ford pour Crown Royal on the ground, but it felt awkward. I mean, two thoughts came up in my mind. One, okay. I don't think he knew what he was doing. One, because
we should take a step. So they announced, they being Diageo, I think, who owns it, that they were going to move a plant to America. But then,
just close to Windsor to the U.S., right?
But then I was reading that a lot of the product, the raw materials, the mash, all still happens here. So, for a second,
right.
if you have got awareness of that, tell me.
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to say. I mean, he was pouring a bottle of Crown Royal that was made in Manitoba, because there's a plant there owned by Diageo, and bottled in Valleyfield, Quebec. Close to where I am right now. And plant in Ontario that's closing was there to service the American market, essentially. So Diageo, which has been thinking about moving the plant south, basically made the decision because tariffs just made the decision much easier for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was pouring a bottle of Crown Royal that was made in Canada and will continue to be made in Canada. If he's asking to boycott Crown Royal, he's basically compromising jobs in Canada, in Manitoba and Quebec.
Not like I said, it's kind of like your Bix pickles example. You know, you're eating pickles that were actually from cucumbers grown in Canada, just shipped back to...
And the other thing that really concerns me, and I think that's the more broader issue here, is that when you see a government picking and choosing winners and losers, that's when you get into trouble, because it will come back and bite you eventually. Because if you're a company looking into Canada, looking at Canada, looking at Ontario, looking at a premier trashing a brand, would you want to invest there? And think that perhaps you may make a decision that may not please Queen's Park or Ottawa or Quebec or anybody really. I mean, you're exposing your company to tremendous risks. And And of course, when you withdraw a product from the market, you're reducing competition and you're pushing prices higher for everything. Now, we're talking about alcohol here, but it can happen into food as well. So I do think that what Premier Ford did was extremely short-sighted and dangerous, to be honest.
Well, I'll give you the whiskey glass half full interpretation of one element of something you said, which is if you are thinking about opening a plant in Canada, you'll be welcomed with open arms. So the same energy around leaving could be doubled when you arrive. So you'd have the support in with the premier. So I don't know. Maybe that's the, like
but,
I said, the whiskey glass
boycott, the suggestion of a boycott, and there's, of course, Unifor, which represents workers in the plant that's closing, is asking for the LCBO to ban Crown Royale. But we're talking about Diageo, which owns Smirnoff and Bailey's and other products. I mean, this is not a small organization here. And so I'm not against boycotts, but it has to be coming from consumers. Consumers should have the last say on anything. If you want to boycott Loblaw, if you want to boycott anything, go ahead. It shouldn't be coming from a politician, let alone a premier of the largest province in the country. You know what? This is the Captain Canada thing. The Captain Canada cry woofing is just too much right now. I think Doug Ford should just wear his Canada's Not For Sale hat and shut up.
Right. Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
I mean,
a lot of people don't agree with me. I mean, they think it's wonderful that he did that.
By the numbers, Premier Ford, who won a record-setting, never done before, third majority. There's been other premiers in Ontario who've won three mandates, but no one's ever won three straight majorities. More details came out polling. He's the most popular premier in the country.
Yep.
So by the numbers, if you're just thinking of it through a political lens, seems to be working. Seems that they like somebody to
politically. I mean, we can talk about politics, but this is not a political pod. I'm just telling you, I'm just presenting you the risks related to what he did this week with the Crown Royale bottle. And by the way, if you want to pour Crown Royale on the ground, just take off the plastic part so it goes faster. He was actually there forever.
Ruined the moment.
I know. Like he had to talk and like he lost the moment.
Not typically an issue with our premier, but anyway. All right, last couple of things. I wanted to ask you, what do you think's in the water at Nestle? Another executive sacked for putting, they own a lot of brands. I was shocked at how many brands they own, but they own the brand Drumstick.
It's the largest agribusiness company in the world.
So many brands. Anyway, it looks like the CEO put his drumstick in the wrong place. I guess their drumstick brands. So he got ratted out by somebody on a complaint line or
when whatever. When you're CEO, don't screw with the payroll. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, geez, you know, it happened when we were on break, but we had the whole, Kiss Cam fiasco with that billionaire CEO on a date with his head of HR.
Yes.
My goodness. What, anyway, is it this some sense of entitlement that nobody's going to touch me and I'm going to do what I want to do, but it's not.
Well, love is love. I mean, we see it at universities, to be honest. I mean, you just have to be extremely careful, because if you're a leader of a company, man or woman, doesn't matter. You are responsible for an entire organization. And if you're seen or if you're perceived as being biased towards certain individuals, when tough decisions are made, i.e. layoffs or cuts and things like that, it's much harder to be seen as someone with integrity. Yeah. And
if somebody wants your job, you've made it easy for them, right?
Well,
just phone the anonymous tip line, and suddenly the ladder is restructured.
Well, the other issue, of course, is that when things are bad, who gets all the hits? And I mean, because I suspect that people knew about it. Some people knew about it, and I mean, corporate politics is always incredibly tough for couples. So I know a lot of people out there are working as a couple in the same organization, but that's never easy. Now, in the food space, there are a lot of family businesses. That's a little different because the family owns the business.
Very different.
Nestle is owned by shareholders. Mm. So
It's been a rocky couple of years. The shareholders have pushed back on everything from DEI to sustainability objectives. And
yep.
Anyway.
It boils down to ethics and integrity. And I do think that if you're a leader of an absolutely. And you want to follow strict rules and be held to a higher standard. I find it quite appropriate. So to see the CEO of Nestle go because of this is, in my view, appropriate. Yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are, but I wasn't surprised.
Yeah. I don't know. I think somebody had it out for him and he made it easy for him. It's kind of like when the Russians set up leaders with cameras.
I don't know how it happened, but to
tip
decide
line, an anonymous tip line. Somebody called in a tip on an anonymous tip.
But as soon as you make a decision as a CEO to start dating someone on payroll, you expose it's your fault. It's your fault.
That's right.
You take the responsibility. There is a risk.
Anyway, I'm sure I'll get like some bazillion pay package. So, you know, we shouldn't feel too sorry for him.
You'll be fine.
Wanted to congratulate. What a change of guard at McDonald's Canada. The president of McDonald's Canada, she was a 40-year veteran of the organization, is effective September 1st. She's retiring.
From Europe.
We got a new, Anne-Marie Swink, I think is her name.
Exactly.
From the Netherlands, young executive, clearly, going from the Netherlands to Canada, looking for international placements. So welcome to her. Maybe we can get her on the podcast and
absolutely
get some observations about what's different in Europe and what she's going to do for the Canadian market. So congratulations to Michel Boudreau, who's retiring after 40 years. So congratulations.
40 years.
Now, speaking of another big retirement, Diane Brisebois is now effectively on to the next and new adventure.
Does she know she's retired?
Well, the new president of Retail Council of Canada.
She's tireless.
Deanne
is just, it was an incredible leader for the retail industry in Canada. And I must say, so she's been a guest on our pod a few years ago and great inspiration. And I wish her well. Absolutely.
Well, I'm pretty sure we have not heard the last of Deanne, and lots of talent and energy. So I may imagine she'll be we'll be hearing from her. And congratulations to Kim Furlong, who takes over as of yesterday or the day before, as of Tuesday, as the new president of Retail Council of Canada. Perhaps we can get Kim on the pod as well and have her introduce herself. She is oversaw advocacy as vice president before my time, so her and I never overlapped. So I'm looking forward to meeting Kim and chatting with her. We'll be together actually in Vancouver towards the end of the month. I'm heading to Vancouver for Retail West. I'm interviewing two great interviews, none in the food business, but one is the president of Best Buy Canada. And second is the founder and chairman of Aritzia, which is one of the most successful Canadian retailers, Brian Hill. So I'm really looking forward to my time.
I have three daughters. They're big fans of Aritzia. Inside out.
And you know it's mostly hand wash, so you know. My goodness. All right. Well, listen, great episode. We got more great interviews coming up next week, and we've got lots of fast-moving commentary. So we'll get back to that next week. Don't forget that you can watch this entire episode online on our YouTube channel. We were a little late posting the last one for technical issues, but we'll be more current in posting this one. So visit our YouTube channel and you can watch us stumble through or watch me stumble through the episode. And until then, I'm Mike LeBlanc, media entrepreneur and keynote speaker. And you are?
I'm the food professor, Sylvain Charlebois.
Safe travels, everybody.
Take care.